Welcome to Speaking Out for the Blind. I'm Brian McCallan. Have you ever wanted to pursue a career in broadcast news, or maybe work in one of many communications or journalism fields? Have you ever wondered what it is like to stand in front of a camera or a mic and tell thousands or millions of listeners or viewers the latest stories of the day? Blind BBC News reporter Gary O'Donohue joins the show today to tell how you can do just that. Gary will also share his early life, career highlights, and how he worked his way up to reporting for both BBC TV and radio. Good morning, Gary.
Good morning, Brian.
So before we talk about your reporting career, I'd like to first ask you about your blindness in early life. London's morning newspaper, called The Independent, reported that you were born partially sighted and then completely lost your vision when you were just 8 years old. How did you lose your vision?
Well, I was born with quite poor sight anyway, and when I was a small baby, one of my eyes was removed and an artificial eye put in when I was about 2 years old. And I had some vision in the other eye, which was useful enough to be able to read print and to get about and ride a bicycle like other kids at the time. But it was pretty precarious. And so when I was about five, I had a detached retina in that one good eye, which they managed to fix. And then when I was 8 years old, in fact, on the day before my eighth birthday, I have a very distinct memory now. I was at a partially sighted school, a school for partially sighted children. And I remember being the first one out into the playground after lunchtime. And I remember climbing a climbing frame there. I don't know what you call them in the US, but we have children have some sort of climbing frames that they can climb up on. And I remember climbing to the top of a climbing frame and then realizing I couldn't see the way down properly. And then realizing there was something seriously wrong with my vision. The other memory I have from that day is that it was actually the first day that my parents had got colour TV. So I went home and I could just barely make out this sort of strange new TV in the corner of the room, because up till then we had black and white television. This was the middle of the 1970s. And so I lost my sight on the first day that we got colour TV. And when we went to the hospital the next day, Moorfields Eye Hospital, fantastic eye hospital here in London, world-famous eye hospital. My surgeon said to me at the time, "Well, not much we can do about it this time, Gary. I'm afraid that's it." So I was pretty much totally blind from then onwards, and have been totally blind now. For 35, 36 years now.
So I was reading the UK's disability magazine. It's called Disability Now. And I learned that you did receive your early education from some of these special schools, these highly academic ones. Tell me about these special schools.
Yeah, when my sight went when I was eight, I was immediately the school I was at, partially sighted school, said that they couldn't really cope with a totally blind child, and they started to teach me Braille, and they also recommended that I go off to a boarding school called Dawson House, which was down in Kent, which is just southeast of London, about an hour and a half from my home in a county called Essex, which is east of London. And I started there when I was 8 years old in the following September, and it was really very difficult going away from home for a whole week at a time, just only coming home at weekends, and it was a huge adjustment. And I suppose when I look back at it, as a child, I'm sure I didn't think this way at the time, but I suspect what I felt was I was sort of being punished for losing my sight. Of course, that's not what people were doing, or not what my parents were doing, but I'm sure I was upset about it because it felt like that. But I spent 3 years at that school, and learnt Braille and learnt to get around without being able to see properly. And at the end of those 3 years, when I was 11, myself and a bunch of us in the same class, we sat an entrance exam for a place called Worcester College for the Blind, as it was called at the time. which was a pretty high-performing academic grammar school, what we call a grammar school in this country, which is a selective school, a school that selects its pupils at age 11 by exam. And we sat the exam for Worcester College, which is up in the Midlands of England. It's sort of about half an hour from Birmingham, really pretty much in the middle of the country, and probably three and a half hours from my parents' home in the south. And I got a place at Worcester College for the Blind, and that meant going away and living away from home for 3, 4, 5 weeks at a time. And I spent from the age of 11 to 18 at Worcester College, and got an absolutely superb education from it. I mean, the best education going. And interestingly, I think a lot better education than I would have got had I been sighted and gone to the local schools that my brothers went to down just outside London. So there's a sort of, an interesting upside to losing one's sight sometimes, that you can actually end up with a better chance in life in other areas.
Let's actually go back a little bit and talk about right before you started with the BBC. Mm. You attended Oxford University, and you studied philosophy and modern languages. How did doing all those philosophic readings and studies and learning all of those modern languages out there prepare you for a career in the field of communication?
Not at all, really, to be honest. I went up to Oxford in 1987 to Christ Church College, and spent 3 years there, and also a year abroad studying in Paris. And really, the subjects I did had no real bearing on the journalism I did afterwards. I was doing subjects that I was just enjoying and wanted to do, And that made no difference at all, actually, to getting a journalism. The thing is probably important. I mean, it's becoming less so in this country, but the thing is to realise in the UK is that really sort of higher education hasn't got involved in teaching journalism until very, very recently. Journalism is regarded more as a trade here rather than a sort of academic pursuit. And so going to journalism school was never a really high priority for employers when they were taking on journalists. They were more interested in people who could write or who could demonstrate, you know, curiosity about life, skepticism about life. And sort of academic qualifications in journalism were never very, very important. That is changing a little bit because a lot of universities are now running journalism courses, but certainly not to the extent that you would have in the US, where all the big schools run major journalism programs, and a lot of the media organizations recruit and hire from those journalism schools. So it's a little bit different in this country. So it was never really a problem, you know, not having formal journalism training, trying to get into the BBC or to any other form of journalism at the time. So I spent 4 years at Oxford, you know, pursuing subjects I really enjoyed, and I didn't regret a moment of it at all, not a moment.
So your first job at the BBC ever was working in photocopying inside the network's Braille production department. And at that Braille department, you copied compliment slips and you just stuffed them into the envelopes. How did you get your foot in the door with this meager starting position? And how did that job prepare you for that reporting career at the BBC?
Actually, I think you've demonstrated one of the dangers of newspaper cuttings, which is that's not actually true.
Really,
that story is an interesting one. I did have a job working in a Braille production department. Actually, at the end of my first year of university in the summer vacation, but it was actually working for a bank, the National Westminster Bank in London, and I did work in their Braille production department, as you say. You know, one of the things you kind of assume as a blind person you would escape is doing the photocopying, but there is this thing called, or used to be this thing called thermoform, which was a way of brailing, putting some braille on a piece of paper, putting it into a machine that laid plastic sheets over it, and you got an impression of the dots. It was a braille photocopier in that sense, but it wasn't using photos. And I did work in that department. I had to cut up these little compliment slips and stuff them into envelopes for blind people with their statements, and I had to proofread all the braille letters that went out to bank customers. Banks were one of the very first institutions in this country. I know banks have a pretty bad name here, both on your side of the pond and on our side of the pond, but banks for blind people were one of the first groups of institutions to really get the idea of communicating with blind people in braille. So this is back in the sort of late 80s. They were sending out braille statements and braille letters to their blind customers because of, obviously, clearly there are, you know, issues around confidentiality, and it was important for them. So I helped out in that. Well, I got paid to help out in that department for a summer, and I was the only man in there. It was full, absolutely full of sort of 19-year-old girls and me. So I suppose that could be seen as a good thing for some, but I mean, they just they spent all their time talking about boyfriends and sunbeds, and I really I got a little bit bored there, I must say.
So, according to Disability Now, you landed a succession of freelance contracts right after you finished school. What were some of the news organizations that you worked with under the contracts, and what were some of your biggest stories, briefly?
Well, I effectively really only ever worked for the BBC. I started getting some contracts with them. I did one or two other little things as well for some independent news organizations, but mainly I would work from the BBC. And I got to work. I left Oxford in 1991. And I got a couple of short contracts that took me through our general election in this country in 1992. And I was working as a reporter for local radio, local BBC radio, but based at Westminster covering the general election of 1992, and had such a whale of a time. And then just after that election in June 92, a whole bunch of jobs came up on this desk where I'd been working. And I chucked my hat into the ring, and I was lucky enough to get one of those. And so I've been a staff reporter for the BBC now for this is my 22nd year now. So I was pretty young. I mean, I was only 22 at the time, and certainly the jobs are a lot harder to come by nowadays. But I was in the right place at the right time, Brian. And there were a couple of people in the organisation who were willing to take a chance on a blind person. I mean, there hadn't really been a blind person working in daily news, you know, sort of daily network news, what I was doing up till that stage. There's been a couple of trailblazers before me, people like Peter White, who presents the In Touch program here in the UK, which I'm sure a lot of your listeners will have heard of, a weekly magazine for blind people on our national network. He'd been a real trailblazer ahead of me, and other people like Kevin Mulhern as well, who's worked on both sides of the Atlantic. But no one had really actually worked in daily news as a reporter, daily mainstream news. And I was very lucky that there were some people in the organisation who were prepared to take a chance on me. And I've spent the last 20-odd years trying to prove that they weren't wrong to.
Well, one of your first major reporting jobs at the BBC was on the network's Today Show. The Today Show, it's BBC Radio 4's longest-running early morning news radio program, and your first story on that show was where you bungee jumped off of London's Chelsea Bridge. Tell me more about this story and how it just felt jumping off that bridge.
Well, that's another problem with the clippings. I was asked to do that, and I said no, and I thought actually I might have burnt my bridges, but fortunately they didn't seem to mind. So I didn't actually bungee jump. I wouldn't dream of bungee jumping off of anything, let alone Chelsea Bridge, which is actually quite near the water. So I'm not sure you wouldn't get a dunking if you did jump off Chelsea Bridge with a bungee jump. But they did suggest I might fancy doing that. But the Today program, which, as you say, it's a huge institution here in Britain. It is the main morning news show that everyone listens to. Politicians and everyone. It's a very big deal here on our national BBC network. And I spent 5 really happy years there as a reporter and got to do a whole variety of things. I mean, everything from, you know, silly pieces about, I remember them, you know, doing silly things in a day about, you know, the latest fashions, this, that, and the other. Not that I knew ever known anything about fashion. But also I got to travel a lot. My first visit to the US was when I was working for the Today Show, and I went and did some pieces over on the West Coast, a series of features over on the West Coast. I went to Kosovo and Macedonia during the NATO bombing there while the war was going on.
Oh, there. Yeah. What was it like reporting from the front lines of that war?
Well, it's all, I mean, you know, it sounds very glamorous and difficult, but actually, you know, you're never really in the midst of it that much. So a lot of it's reporting on refugees, a lot of it's, you know, hanging around sort of feeding centers and things like that. But when we actually got into the middle of Kosovo after the Serbs had left, sort of going, it's extraordinary. I remember going to the central post office in Pristina, which is the capital of Kosovo, which had had an airstrike hit it. And, you know, you imagine these smart bombs and these cruise missiles, but the sheer devastation that these things create. I mean, we were just sort of clambering through something that had been a huge building that was just rubble. And I still have at home a post office book that I sort of pulled from the ruins that was, you know, it's obviously been in there at the time when it hit, you know, someone's post office book. As a sort of horrible memento, I suppose. But, you know, the sheer devastation that this stuff does, it really impresses upon you. And, you know, and we also visited, and I wrote a piece about this at the time, we also visited a sort of, I suppose you'd call it a hospital, a psychiatric hospital, just on the outskirts of the city. And there were some very, very unhappy specimens of humanity there. Quite a lot of disabled people as well who'd been lumped in with people with mental illness and everything, and they'd been effectively tied to their beds because there weren't enough staff to look after them. The place was absolutely disgusting, terrible, terrible mess. People wandering around without any care. It was a really shocking, really shocking thing to see. And I was pretty young at the time. I was 28 at the time, and you know, I'd never seen anything like that. And it was quite an awakening, I must say, quite an awakening. So I did that. I've also been to went to Australia with the Today Show to do some items there, and I also did some reporting on the handover of Hong Kong when Britain handed Hong Kong over to China, back to China after its 98-year lease. Did some stuff there. Reported a lot from Europe, of course. I've just come back from a trip back around. I mean, I don't work for the Today Show anymore. I'm what's called the chief political correspondent now for BBC News, so I work for all various bits of the BBC at the same time, programmes and news, television and radio. And I've just come back from a trip with our main opposition leader here, Ed Miliband, who's the leader of the Labour Party, and he was doing a little tour of Scandinavia, Sweden and Denmark and Netherlands and other places as well. So I get to travel a little bit with my job. And I hope to do some more of that soon. In fact, they're just about to send me on a course, what they call the Hostile Environment course, which I did many years ago, but it's my training has lapsed slightly, where they send you away for a whole week scaring you, really, in preparation if you have to go to anywhere dangerous, you know, Afghanistan. If we travel, the Prime Minister often goes to Afghanistan to meet the troops. If we travel with him, we have to have this training. So I'm going on a week very shortly with some old ex-military types who sort of wave guns at you. I'm basically tell you to spend the week telling you if someone's got a gun, do what they say. Which is a good rule to me.
Yeah, it sure is. So let's talk about your other television appearances here for a little bit outside of reporting. I heard from the Internet Movie Database, IMDb.com, that you were a celebrity contestant on the BBC game show Mastermind.
That's true.
Tell me more about Mastermind and your experience on the show.
Well, Mastermind, the show Mastermind has been running in this. It's a quiz show, and it's a very, very sort of pared down quiz show. And what I mean by that is there's no glitz and glamour to it. Effectively, it's a general knowledge quiz that they run it every year, and it's been running for decades in this country. And it has some very dramatic music that starts it off. And all it is a questioner and four contestants. And one of the great images of Mastermind is what they call the black chair, which is where the person who's being questioned sits. And each of the four contestants come out and they sit in the black chair and they have to answer 2 minutes of questions on a special subject, their own special subject of their own choosing. And then in the second round of the show, they answer 2 minutes of general knowledge questions. And they have a bunch of these heats, you know, which are going on at the moment. And then they have a final, and then they have a winner for the whole year. And then they do it all over again next year. But what they've started doing in recent times around Christmas time is having what they call a celebrity version of Mastermind, effectively for charity. And they asked me to be on it last Christmas, not this Christmas, just on the one before. And so I said I would. It was a bit of a high risk strategy because you could end up looking a right idiot if you crash and burn on that. But I did okay. I came second in my show, so I'm pretty pleased with that. And I chose Winston Churchill as my special subject and did a bit of reading up. I knew quite a lot about him anyway. I'd read lots of biographies, but did a bit of cramming in the days before that. And it was a really, really interesting experience. And I was on with a few other people. No one you really would have heard of in the US, I don't think. There was a designer called Wayne Hemingway, who's quite a famous clothes designer in this country. He runs a label called Red or Dead, which some people might have heard of from the 70s. And then there was a comedian, quite a famous comedian here. And then a lady from another game show. I can't remember exactly, but it was a great experience, and I went to record the show up in Manchester, and my daughter came along with me, Lucy, and she's very excited because we got our own dressing room and things like that, with a star on the door, so she was very keen on that whole idea, and it was all done for charity, and it was a great experience and great fun.
So how can our listeners here in the U.S. and around the world listen to or see all of your BBC news reports and shows?
I think that's quite very difficult. I mean, some of them will be available on the BBC website to search. I mean, as a reporter, the problem is that, you know, I don't have my own show, so I pop up at various points when there's a story. But there will be some stuff you could search on the BBC website, I'm sure. But I don't have my own archive or anything like that. Maybe I should do that at some point.
It
does feel like, you know, we deal in day-to-day news. It feels very ephemeral. You know, it's like what they used to say about newspapers. You know, it's tomorrow's chip paper, which is, for wrapping your fish and chips in. So maybe I should think about doing that. But there will be some stuff on the BBC News website if you stick my name in, I'm sure. You'll be able to listen to and watch. One of my most, there's quite a lot on YouTube as well. One of my most famous television appearances is certainly on YouTube, which is I was reporting for the 10 o'clock news one, I think it was a Sunday night a year or two ago, and I was standing outside the front door of Downing Street, number 10 Downing Street, which is where the Prime Minister lives in this country and where we do a lot of our live broadcasts from into the main news bulletins. And lo and behold, and I didn't realize this, of course, because it was behind me, there was a huge rat appeared on the doorstep of number 10 Downing Street and started running across the back of the shot. And everyone could see it and it caused a bit of a sort of storm on the social networks. And I think they even played a clip of it in Russia. Russia Today, I think, played a clip of it in their morning news bulletin because it was so funny, and it led to Downing Street actually getting themselves a cat to try and catch this damn rat. So the live broadcast with the rat in the background is probably my most famous appearance to date, which is a bit depressing, but there you go.
How funny. So how can people search for that? What do they type into YouTube?
Okay, I think if you put Gary O'Donoghue and rat, you'll certainly find it, or Downing Street and Rat.
Okay.
It'll come up. And you'll have to have pretty good eyesight to see this rat, but I'm sure you can. And otherwise, the BBC website is www.bbc.co.uk for the main BBC website, or bbcnews.com for outside the UK also works well. And also, I mean, I'd mention it at this stage just because I've just been involved with it. Well worth those listeners, Brian, who use the Apple iPhone or the iPad or that. I've just been involved in updating the BBC News app.
Oh, fabulous.
Making it much more friendly for voiceover. And the developers inside the BBC have been talking to me and showing me, you know, different builds of the software, and I've been making suggestions. And it's now a lot more usable. In fact, the version has just gone up on the App Store yesterday or the day before. And it's well worth a look at if there are those news junkies out there that want to get a good news app. It's really, I mean, the version before wasn't very usable with voiceover, but this one is really good. Still a few improvements to make, but it's well worth a look if any of your listeners have Apple products and use voiceover.
Is it free?
It's free.
Awesome. Yep. So, what advice would you have for those listeners out there that want to get into your business? What advice would you have for them?
Several things, I think I'd say. One is be honest with yourself that it's really what you want to do, because I don't know anyone in the world I work in who has sort of drifted into it. All of them have wanted to do it very, very clearly. So be clear about what you want. Don't take no for an answer. There will be lots of people along the way who will be skeptical about whether or not you can do the job as a blind person. And we know that's true, don't we? We get that day to day in our lives with people, not necessarily people who are being malicious, but they just don't believe it. They just don't believe these things are possible. So don't take no for an answer. I would use every contact you've got. Networking is very, very important. Have lots of ideas. Journalism and broadcasting and all these things, it's an ideas game. You know, no one turns up in a newsroom and says, give me a job. But they might give you a job if you turn up and say, I've got a really good idea for doing a piece about this or a feature about that. What do you think? Would you take that? So have ideas. Get across the technology. I've made a point over the years of sort of being my own IT consultant, because big organizations particularly never really get their head round specialist technology. You know, they're never really sure how it works. And you know, you're never going to get someone in an organization who knows more about a screen reader than you do. So make sure you're an expert, because the information, access to information and getting information quickly is key in the journalism game. So try and become expert at, you know, how to manipulate websites, how to use news feeds, you know, how to get to the information you need quickly. I'll do that. And just be astute with people, I suppose. I mean, at the end of the day, the great thing about journalism from a blind person's point of view is that it really does boil down to talking to people. You know, being able to pick up the phone, talk to someone, get them to tell you some information, get them to tell you what's going on, face-to-face, on the phone. You know, I always say that, certainly in the early days when I used to have to go out as a reporter and knock on doors and talk to people, you know, people always slightly hesitated. They hesitated a small amount longer shutting the door in a blind bloke's face than they would in anyone else's face. So you might as well use that as well, that small advantage. Make sure if you're keen on it, make sure you pursue it and be stubborn about it and don't let anyone put you off, because people will try.
Yes, and Gary, you inspire us all to go out there and just pursue our dreams. Because of your exciting career, some of our listeners out there may just want to indeed become the next television or radio news professional, or seek a career in the fields of journalism and communications. Thanks for joining us today.
It's been a great pleasure, Brian. Thank you for having me.
That's all for this edition of Speaking Out for the Blind. Thanks for listening. And remember to speak out.
You are listening to American Council for the Blind Radio.
By the blind, for the blind.